Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, what few people understand about Martin Luther King Jr.'s life and philosophy. Then, the effect of incivility and vilification on public policy, political participation, and the actual psychology of citizens.
Now, the job facing the nation today is to get rid of poverty. We are the richest nation in the history of the world. Our national gross product this year is about $800 billion. That is what it is, the richest nation in the history of the world. It wouldn't take much to do what I'm talking about. It wouldn't take a great percentage of that national gross product to do what I'm talking about. If the haves are willing to somehow join hands with the have-nots and armed with compassionate traveler's checks, journey into that other country of their brother's hurt and denial and neglect, it wouldn't take that much. We've done it before.
While much of the country remembers Martin Luther King Jr. as primarily a leader of civil rights and desegregation and a great orator, our next guests say he stood for so much more. But many aspects of his life, legacy, and philosophy remain either unknown or conveniently forgotten. We are joined by three experts. David Garrow is a professor of history and law at the University of Pittsburgh School of Law. His publications include The FBI in Martin Luther King Jr., Bearing the Cross, Martin Luther King Jr. and the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, and he is co-editor of The Eyes on the Prize Civil Rights Reader. He also served as senior advisor for Eyes on the Prize, the award-winning PBS television history series. Thomas Jackson is a professor of history at the University of North Carolina, Greensboro. He's the author of From Civil Rights to Human Rights, Martin Luther King Jr. and the Struggle for Economic Justice. Joshua Inwood is a professor of geography and Africana studies at the University of Tennessee. His publications include Searching for the Promised Land, Examining Dr. Martin Luther King's Concept of the Beloved Community, and Street Naming and the Politics of Belongings. Welcome to the three of you. Thank you so much for being with us here on the Scholar Circle. Thomas Jackson, you wrote in your book, From Civil Rights to Human Rights, that to understand Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. fully, we must understand who inspired him and whom he sought to persuade. Who did inspire him and who did he seek to persuade?
That is great and sweeping question. One of the theses of my book is that there's a remarkable consistency over his life course in the degree to which he thought that you couldn't really achieve racial justice without economic justice and indeed without addressing issues of international peace. And that seems to be just a consistent thread throughout his life. His father and grandfather inspired him as sort of social gospel ministers dedicated to serving their communities. When he was in college and then graduate school, people like Howard Thurman, dean of chapel at Boston University, he was influenced by Reinhold Niebuhr, the socialist theologian in Detroit. His reading of Walter Rauschenbusch from the 19th century, a social gospel minister. This is sort of social gospel or even socialist Protestant thinkers and preachers. And that was quite formative. But there's a whole group of them around Howard University who had been influenced by Gandhi as well, but also by egalitarian and revolutionary idea of Christianity. He sought to persuade everybody. He sought to persuade and bring together what you would need to produce a national reform constituency first, and then what he hoped would be a revolution of values. So principally, he was speaking to black communities to get them committed and mobilized for protest, and that was a rhetoric of black unity and Christian service. He sought to speak to the vast middle class majority, the electorate, in terms that would appeal to their sense of patriotism, but also fairness and justice, and in many ways their religious commitment to the least among them. And he sought to persuade policy elites. So he had a whole circle of advisors, and he sought to be an advocate, not only for civil rights legislation, but beyond that, for a robust war on poverty that would include things like job creation and free medical care on models that he saw in Scandinavia and Western Europe. He was also someone who self-consciously spoke to to the world. I think if you look at his Nobel acceptance speech and his Nobel lecture, go to that and see the degree to which, as a kind of prophetic Christian leader, he thought that he really needed to speak to issues of international peace and economic distribution.
David Garrow.
He was first and foremost a Baptist minister. King identified as a preacher. The Dr. King that you can hear in the recorded church sermons which have survived is almost always oftentimes a more powerful, more personal, more striking speaker than when you listen to King giving a civil rights talk at some college or university, for example. Both when he was in seminary at Crozer Theological Seminary, when he's in graduate school at Boston. As Tom mentioned, good many of the theologians and thinkers that he read during those school years, Reinhold Niebuhr in particular, had a significant impact on him. But more often than anything else, King is speaking from the Bible.
Joshua Inwood.
You know, as a geographer, I think one of the things that I find so interesting about King is he leads this movement that is arguably the most transformable to the spaces and places of the United States, at least since first contact with white Europeans with Native Americans. And I think the thing that you have to keep in mind with King, and I think when you think about King, is at his most basic level, he makes an argument for the way that we should live and connect with each other in the idea of community. And when I think about King and when I think about the things that really inspired him and some of the intellectual currents that he draws from that both Tom and David allude to in their work, it is that connection to space and place, which is very important to understand his transformative power as a social thinker and as a social revolutionary.
Josh Inwood, there's a concept that you articulated in one of your papers, which was the beloved community. How do you explain this?
As both David and Thomas talked about, King is first and foremost a Baptist minister, but King is also able to draw from both intellectual currents, European intellectual currents, and also currents within the African American community to really articulate a kind of idea of community that he talks about as the beloved community, which is really a space where all lives are interconnected and respected, and where he hopes you can transform individual lives through the transformative power of what he talks about as agape love. And so for King, he really makes distinctions between these three forms of love, between an eros, which is a kind of romantic love, philia, which is the kind of love and companionship that friendship has. But then he talks about agape. And at its most basic level, agape is the ability to tell your oppressor that what you're doing to me is not only wrong and dehumanizes me, but it also dehumanizes you. And so when King is articulating this notion of a beloved community, he is really talking and working and thinking about the transforming of these relationships, both black-white relationships, but also ultimately, as Thomas outlines in his book, you know, he's really building towards this economic argument that its final manifestation in the Poor People's Campaign. If you go back and you look at the Poor People's Campaign and what King was trying to do in 1967 and 1968, particularly in Washington, D.C., getting people to come to Washington, that is the manifestation of what that beloved community is. And there was a whole political program that was tied to the Poor People's Campaign, everything from a kind of guaranteed national income to universal health care, to also trying to get folks to understand and engage with one another in a different kind of level than had been going on in the 1960s in the United States.
This leads to an aspect that all three of you have discussed in your papers about the difference between the memory of Martin Luther King Jr. and the reality of it. Thomas Jackson, you wrote that we remember him, Dr. King, primarily as the leader of the civil rights movement that would end legal segregation. But really, his philosophy was so much broader and so much deeper than this memory of him. What more do we need to understand about the omissions to understand him? And why do you think we have these omissions?
We tend to freeze him in time and think that he didn't develop or address issues like the Vietnam War or like these deeper issues of poverty that revealed themselves to be so intractable after the Civil Rights Act. So we tend to remember and freeze him in time and identify him with the dream. In order to get a national holiday, the nation, I think, needed to arrive at a more of a consensus picture of who this man was. Even though Mrs. King, in the congressional hearings, said, "Here is your opportunity, nation, to make a national holiday and to celebrate a man who died in the service of labor rights for the sanitation workers of Memphis." But that is, as you suggest, occluded or elided in our consensus national celebrations, and nothing more evident than in the 50th anniversary of the March on Washington. There are other communities, though, and you've heard of some samplings already, of people who remember different things that he said to audiences he was appealing to. Michael Honey, written a lot about King as a labor leader and who tried to forge a black labor alliance with so many unions. He didn't go on picket lines all the time, but rhetorically and in terms of his vision, it was very much one in which workers' rights and the rights especially to decent wages and collective bargaining protections were as sacred as the rights to life and liberty. So I think we don't remember that for the same reason that we have business pages of newspapers and not labor pages of newspapers. So there's a lot of contestation. I mean, a lot of people want to claim King as an opponent of affirmative action, or I got into an argument with his niece, whether he would have been a Republican today or not. So in order for the nation to celebrate him every year, there seems to be a least common denominator, but the richness of his activism and his life lives on, and you can see it in all these groups that try to keep his memory alive, especially the peace groups at the March on Washington, who were directly challenging the Obama administration's policies abroad in using King's words. There's a lot of debate and contestation within that legacy. It's not like it's a frozen or one-dimensional legacy.
David Garrow, you too have emphasized these omitted aspects. You actually used the word distorted in terms of Dr. King's vision. What do you see as the distortions?
I think most listeners are probably quite unfamiliar with how Dr. King sounded during the last 3 years of his life, 1966 to 1968. The King of those years was a very harshly spoken critic, not only of American foreign policy and the war in Vietnam, but of economic inequality here in the United States. And both in terms of what we can correctly label a democratic socialist economic vision that he's articulating those years, and how he, in very tough language, is denouncing the U.S. government's military behavior in Southeast Asia. King is a much tougher critic of the United States and American society than is really ever underscored at January holiday celebration.
Joshua Inwood, you haven't used the word distortion, but you noted some contradictions, particularly around this issue of militarism.
I very much agree with what David just said. King did not mince words when he talked about the triple evils of modern society, what he refers to as racism, materialism, and militarism. When he speaks to materialism, he's really thinking about kind of the unfettered capital accumulation that is both going on in the United States, but then also spreading throughout the world. And I think really if listeners want to get into this in a way and really try to understand how King had changed and how he had come to terms with American both militarism and capitalism, you really need to turn to his book, Where Do We Go From Here? Chaos or Community. And in many respects, this is King's most radical work. And King is unabashed when he talks about how American military soldiers who are standing in solidarity and burning villages in Vietnam would never be able to live on the same street in Detroit, Michigan. In many respects, you go back and you look at King in the 1960s, and we are still struggling and still trying to come to terms with many of those triple evils in society. We have got governors throughout this country who refuse to expand Medicaid rolls for poor and low-income folks, who very much practice a kind of economic revanchism in engaging with poor communities. We have a government who is at least potentially wrapping up American citizens in surveillance. And if you think about King's life in terms of the COINTEL program, it's the same kinds of things that he spoke about. We are also in the midst of debates in the Congress where we have seen long-term unemployment benefits cut from poor and working people who have been unable to find jobs. We've got food stamp cuts that have been enacted or being debated. And we really are struggling again with those things that King talked about, particularly as it relates to those triple evils of modern society.
That's a perfect place to go into some of the struggles that he did face and the FBI surveillance of Dr. King. But let me first remind our listeners that you're listening to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. We're talking with Joshua Inwood, David Garrow, and Thomas Jackson, who are experts on Martin Luther King. David Garrow, you've looked at the FBI's surveillance of Dr. King.
The FBI first began targeting Dr. King in 1962 and 1963 in the belief that he probably was being influenced by certainly one or more than one advisors who had previously been secretly active in and loyal to the American Communist Party in the early 1950s. So that hypothesis is what leads Robert Kennedy, as U.S. Attorney General, to authorize the wiretapping of Dr. King. The FBI, on its own, without any approval from the Attorney General, also begins using bugs as electronic recording devices, as distinct from telephone wiretaps, against Dr. King. And all of that electronic surveillance quickly leads the FBI into an entirely prurient interest in Dr. King's private life. So you have really incredibly distasteful government surveillance being targeted at King during all of the mid-1960s. But the FBI's surveillance of Dr. King was not unique. They were deploying even more electronic attention towards, for instance, the Nation of Islam, a quite small black sect that had really very little influence on anything. But the echoes of the FBI's behavior during the 1960s and early 1970s with the scope of government surveillance practices that we've all read about is a very, very powerful echo.
You mentioned RFK's authorization of the wiretap. How did the relationship eventuate between RFK, JFK, and Martin Luther King Jr.?
Both of the Kennedy brothers, from May and June of 1963 onward, were very strongly supportive of the civil rights movement and very actively in concert with Dr. King, notwithstanding what J. Edgar Hoover's FBI is consistently whispering in their ears. The same pattern then continues when Lyndon Johnson becomes president after John F. Kennedy's assassination. Johnson very courageously stands with King and the movement, especially in 1965, in putting forward the Voting Rights Act. But secretly behind the scenes, Johnson and scores of others know that the FBI is distributing and trying to peddle both these communist influence allegations and all of this detail about King's private life. But under the journalistic standards of the 1960s, nobody, television or newspapers, is actually using any of that FBI rumor. So there's a weird disjuncture between what people in government know privately and the public record of broadcast and news.
May I jump in here? It's Tom Jackson.
Yes.
I want to support that, but also, qualify or complicate it. I agree. I don't think King was. I think he might have been concerned and maybe a bit intimidated, but it didn't suppress what he was willing to go out on a limb on. And I think the work I'm doing right now in 1963 and 1964 suggests that King and a number of other civil rights leaders, while working in concert with Kennedy and Johnson, also tried to put pressure for more, especially for more robust economic policies, but also for more vigorous protection for civil rights and civil liberties in Southern voting rights campaigns where people were being murdered and brutalized. So that when David talks about King's radicalism from 66 to 68, I see that already in 63 and 64. And it's the FBI can't suppress things that he says. There's a speech when he returns from his Nobel Prize. And it's not the FBI, it's the New York Times that doesn't get the word out. He comes back, first of all, the Times quotes him as basically saying, "I'm returning with a conviction that nonviolence is the answer to the crucial political and moral questions of our time." Well, sitting there in the audience is Robert Wagner, mayor of New York, Vice President Hubert Humphrey, and later on that night, the same speech that Malcolm X hears. What King actually says in this speech, and hasn't yet been published, is that before he went to Oslo, he thought the war on poverty. He thought it'd be a step in the direction of establishing economic justice, and he was encouraged by the Pope's powerful message on poverty after his visit to India, that nations really need to cease their armament race and devote themselves to assisting those who lack food, clothing, shelter, and medical care. He says, though, in Norway and Sweden, whose economies are literally dwarfed by the size of our affluence and the extent of our technology, they have no unemployment and no slums. Men, women, and children have long enjoyed free medical care and quality education. And he says, this contrasts to the limiting and halting steps of the war on poverty. Our rich nation is deeply troubling when more than 40 million Americans, white and Negro, live in grinding poverty. Today, that number hasn't basically changed a bit more. The poverty rate, ironically, is higher today. So he was speaking to these issues back in that era of civil rights reform and cooperation with liberalism. But the press wasn't picking up on the message. If you listen to the audio tape of him talking to John Kennedy immediately after the March on Washington, he and the rest of the civil rights leadership is saying, we need full employment, we need a jobs program, we need something much more vigorous than what you're offering. And Kennedy kind of deflects them and says, no, we need you to support the civil rights bill and to exert your influence on Republicans. So there is both cooperation and kind of challenge and conflict going on, even in that period, on these very issues that most people think only emerged later. They were already on the table in 63 and 64.
Thomas Jackson, since you're talking about the media, there's a section of your book that talks about how the media obsesses about violence and really makes the story about violence. And perhaps that's why they're emphasizing the nonviolent talk. But I think you even have a quote in your book about how they are tallying up broken heads.
Box scores of broken heads. That's a quote from Pat Waters, a famous journalist of the Southern Movement, when he's denouncing the way in which newspapers covered the essentially nonviolent black movement. They're basically, what's newsworthy is when these things become violent and there's a fight. But I do think that it's kind of a huge smokescreen. When you look at the March on Washington, for example, half the news coverage is about, is this going to turn violent? How do we avoid violence? What logistics of control are necessary to prevent violence? And then after the march, what a relief that it was nonviolent and how praiseworthy that the Negro leadership was able to keep it nonviolent. And so that obsession with violence is very much noise and tends to drown out some of the substantive grievances and demands like civil liberties, protections, or jobs.
Joshua Inwood, let's put this into a geographic context. One way that you've looked at this is how memory has been created through, say, naming street signs after Martin Luther King and such.
There's kind of two ways to think about that. And we've talked a bit about the way that King is memorialized and the way that King is remembered. And the thing about memorials are, it's a way of concretizing an image. You can see that in the Washington, D.C. memorial, where you've got that image of King and that larger statue and the words that are inscribed in the monument. And it's really a kind of moment for us to think about and to recall certain aspects of King's legacy. But in recalling certain aspects of King's legacy, we are also forgetting other aspects of King's legacy. And so I think we always have to be a little bit careful when we start to memorialize leaders. And I think it's incredibly important where you have someone like King, who really is a social revolutionary, about how we kind of come to think about him and how we come to memorialize him. But I think it's also important to remember as well on King Day that King's work was only possible because there were thousands of others who were willing to not only take to the streets, but to do the hardcore political organizing that is necessary for someone like King and his mission and his activism to have success. And you can see that in countless spaces and countless places, particularly in the American South. If you go to Alabama, if you go to Mississippi, there's a lot of folks there who are working very hard behind the scenes to register people for the NAACP, to register people for the right to vote. That's what King is able to draw on and draw from when the political conditions come together to make his activism possible. We tend to think about King as just emerging here in the 1950s as kind of this great leader. But the reason he was able to emerge in the 1950s with the Montgomery bus boycott is because the political conditions had been created because of decades of struggle that had come before it. So that is something that is very important to think about as we think about 21st century American spaces and places, and with the ways that we can engage in the contemporary struggle to take on many of the inequalities that Thomas just alluded to. Because, I mean, unemployment or poverty, for example, we still live with large numbers of poor people despite the fact that we've been, quote unquote, at war with poverty for 50 years. So that is something I think that listeners need to pay special attention to on King Day and when thinking about King and his legacy and what he means both to us and for us as a nation.
There are two things that brings up. One is the celebrity obsession that our culture has that does discount the rest of the community.
Yeah.
The other aspect, which I think this was also in Thomas Jackson's book, dealt with King as the mediator between the sort of moderate and militant movements for civil rights. He thought they were both ineffective on their own.
No question about it. I think another thing that we have to keep in mind about King's legacy is there was also a very conservative African-American element that was as distrustful of King as some of the more radical elements in the African-American community. And so King is constantly buffered between these different aspects of the African-American community, these different parts of the African-American community, as he is trying to navigate this very complex political situation that presents itself in the 1960s in the United States.
David Garrow.
Certainly, Josh made perhaps the most important point of all, and that's that the civil rights struggle was a mass movement. Yeah. People think of King as the leader of it, but it's more accurate to think of him as a spokesperson for it. In the Nobel Prize context, he stressed that he was a trustee representing all of these tens of thousands of other people. He indeed should be seen as a representative of others and not just as a singular leader.
Well, gentlemen, thank you for your work and thank you for sharing it with us here on the Scholar Circle.
Thank you, Maria.
Thank you very much.
Great pleasure.
David Garrow is a professor of history and law at the University of Pittsburgh School of Law. His publications include The FBI in Martin Luther King Jr., Bearing the Cross, Martin Luther King Jr. and the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, and he is co-editor of The Eyes on the Prize, Civil Rights Reader. Thomas Jackson is a professor of history at the University of North Carolina, Greensboro. He's the author of From Civil Rights to Human Rights, Martin Luther King Jr. and the Struggle for Economic Justice. Joshua Inwood is a professor of geography and Africana studies at the University of Tennessee. His publications include Searching for the Promised Land, Examining Dr. Martin Luther King's Concept of the Beloved Community, and Street Naming and the Politics of Belonging. When we come back, the effects of incivility and vilification on public policy, political participation, and the psychology of citizens. Stay tuned.
Thank you.
welcome to the Scholar Circle. I'm Maria Armudian. Politics in the U.S. have become increasingly hostile and uncivil in the past, say scholars. Language often vilifies fellow citizens and lawmakers. But Americans overwhelmingly dislike the incivility and have expressed shame at its effect on policy debates. What are the effects of incivility and vilification in a democratic society? Do they have real effects on the public policy? Does it affect political participation or the psychology of the citizens? We're joined by three experts. Robert Entman is professor of media and public affairs and professor of international affairs at the George Washington University. He is author of Projections of Power, Framing News, Public Opinion, and U.S. Foreign Policy and Mediated Politics, Communication in the Future of Democracy. His upcoming book is Scandal and Silence, Media Responses to Presidential Misconduct. Stephen Hayman is professor of law at Chicago Kent College of Law. He is the author of Free Speech and Human Dignity and the editor of Hate Speech in the Constitution. Michael Wagner is professor of political science at the University of Nebraska-Lincoln, and he is the co-author of Political Behavior and Midterm Elections. He's also co-author of The Consequences of Political Vilification. Let's start with the old idea of deliberation. Michael Wagner, your literature review reminds us about the benefits of real deliberation on political issues and how all sides come out ahead. Give us the overview about what democratic deliberation offers when people communicate about their disagreements.
Democratic theorists have long extolled the need for quality debate and compromise among lawmakers, and so governance requires at least political elites to deliberate and work together in order to come to some kind of consensus. The question, of course, is what is the quality of that deliberation, and is there something about what happens when the quality of that deliberation changes that can affect basic democratic processes like compromise or support for compromise or the willingness for Americans to civically engage? And so with my co-authors Beth Tice Morse and Donna Jean Mitchell, we think that there is, and we think that when rhetoric is particularly nasty, something we call vilification, it affects people's willingness to compromise, both in terms of individual citizens' willingness to accept compromise and possibly even lawmakers' willingness to compromise across partisan lines. And so that's kind of where we begin our analysis.
That's just an ideal that we have never had. Robert Entman.
Well, it may well be that our image of the past tends to be golden and unrealistic. So I'm not sure for how many generations we had what we would now call civil as opposed to uncivil discourse. But I would say that probably the era that much of political science and democratic theory is based in is the 50s and 60s, and that was a time when there was a different tone in Washington, but not just a different tone, a respect for certain rules of the game, which includes pretty much telling the truth, pretty much actually desiring to solve policy problems. And those are two things that have gone by the wayside.
So you would say that it has deteriorated, it has become more uncivil, and it's not something that historically has always been there.
Correct.
Steve Hayman?
There's a deep ambivalence in our First Amendment on the subject that you're asking about. There's a very strong theme in the Supreme Court's decisions about the First Amendment protecting a meaningful dialogue of ideas, a give and take between citizens where each of us has the right and the duty to express our own views, to listen to the views of other people, to try to understand where they're coming from. So that's one central image of the First Amendment. But at the same time, there's also sort of a different view that the First Amendment is meant to protect speech that may be abrasive, that may be sharply critical of public officials or of other groups within the society, and that the First Amendment almost exists to protect offensive speech because it is uncivil or because it challenges existing conventions.
I definitely want to get into the legal issues in a little bit more nuance in a bit. Perhaps we should discuss the concepts of what it means to have incivility. Bob Entman, you said there are two kinds of incivility. What do you mean?
The kind of incivility we always talk about tends to be the impoliteness and kind of nasty rhetoric and personal insult. And that's important, and it's troubling when we have that kind of incivility. But the Oxford English Dictionary has a second definition, and I think that's actually our bigger problem now. And the second definition is orderly state of a country, social order as distinct from anarchy and disorder. And what I believe is that not that we're in a state of anarchy, but we're in a state in which we have disordered politics and disordered governance. And that's the real problem. And it comes down to the tendency of certain political actors to disregard what had been a longstanding norm of telling the truth and not deliberately making things up and sticking to those points if they win you political power.
For
example, climate change.
You talked about this, that this was a party strategy to keep winning. Can you explain how you find this strategy and what the reaction has been from the other party?
The strategy is actually to create this disorder and to create bad governance, because that's a way to discourage people from believing that government can solve problems and to encourage them to support so-called smaller government. And if you do that, in some senses, it doesn't really matter if that's your real goal, that is keeping power and shrinking the size of government and shrinking what government does, then it doesn't really matter what you're saying specifically, because that's the simple goal and that's the simple target. And from the point of view of the other party, it becomes very difficult to conduct a civilized dialogue from either side if one of the sides is really refusing to acknowledge some facts that most everyone who is intellectually honest would agree are indeed factual. So, you know, my main point is that we really have to name this problem more carefully. And it is a problem of the Republican Party having decided on this strategy, having moved sharply to the right, the Democratic Party trying to induce compromise on the part of the Republicans, and the Republicans responding by really not having any incentive or inclination to compromise in the interest of solving the problem. The real interest is shrinking the government and actually maintaining and expanding their power. That's an unfortunate thing. I know it sounds like I'm being partisan when I identify the problem as that, but I believe that's where we are, and I believe it's important to name the problem as it is so we can maybe do something about it.
This is one form of incivility. Michael Wagner takes a specific. Michael Wagner, you study political vilification of the other side. How do you distinguish the vilification from these other kinds of incivility?
I think Bob did a good job defining the kind of incivility that he wishes we would focus less on when he was describing, you know, kind of impoliteness, name-calling, derision of the opponent, those sorts of things, as being something that's uncivil with respect to discourse in American politics. Incivility has some effects on how people respond to political debate when they see it amongst political elites. What my colleagues and I want to argue is that there's something that we call vilification, which we make the argument that that's different than incivility. And so our argument is that incivility comprises name-calling, derision of the opponent, you know, impoliteness, things of that nature. And vilification calls the other side evil, malevolent, ungenuine, bent on destroying the country. So they ascribe a particular motive. It's not just that the other side are jerks. It's not just that the other side won't agree on the facts. It's that they're evil. It's that they're dangerous. And our argument is that when people are exposed to that kind of rhetoric, it makes some people way less likely to want to compromise, and it makes others way more likely to want to compromise. And much in the way that Bob makes the argument that the Republican Party has adopted a particular strategy, we make the argument that Republicans and Democrats in the electorate respond differently to vilification. So when Republicans see their party vilified, we find that they know who the enemy is, and there's no way they're going to compromise with them. If they come out and call us evil and dangerous, we're never going to make a political agreement with those folks, and we wouldn't support our leaders if they did. We find that Democrats in the electorate, when they see their party vilified, when they see their party called evil and dangerous, they become much more supportive of compromise. They want the fighting to stop. They want to come to some kind of solution as compared to keeping the attacks going. And so this has real implications for how governance works, because if you were the Democratic Party, you might not get much purchase out of attacking the other side in this particular way, because it's going to entrench your opponents and it's going to make your side want to compromise. And so, you know, there's some linkages, I think, with what Bob is talking about in terms of why the politics of today are the way that they are. What we don't know is how this has really varied over time. And so that's something that we're trying to investigate. That takes a really long time. And so I can't speak to whether the language is specifically worse now than it used to be. but I think our data does suggest that people in the electorate respond differently to vilifying attacks, and they don't respond that way just when the attacks are uncivil or when the facts or when the attacks are based on factual disputes. People don't have those same reactions in terms of their support of compromise or supporting other kinds of democratic principles.
I think I want to quickly talk about one more layer. There's one more level of this incivility vilification, and that is hate speech and harmful speech that is actually a legal issue. And Steve Heyman, this is where we bring you in. What distinguishes harmful speech and hate speech from other kinds of political speech?
You could view hate speech as being the most extreme form of the kind of speech that Bob and Mike were just talking about. That is, if you go one step even beyond vilification, beyond accusing your political opponents of being evil, if you go so far as to actually dehumanize them, to treat them as though they were subhuman, as though they're not entitled to the respect that you would give to other human beings or citizens, and in particular, if you abuse and degrade other people on the basis of their race or their ethnicity or their religion or their gender or their sexual orientation, that's what I would regard as being hate speech.
What if they were degraded with regards to their political ideology? Now, so far, we don't have that as a legal category. But one of the things that we have seen change in American discourse as the ultra-right airwaves have emerged is that liberals have been called all of these kind of dehumanized names. But we haven't seen that emerge yet in the legal world.
That's right. And I think the reason for that is that the Supreme Court regards the right to sharply disagree about political issues to be right at the core of the First Amendment. And so to the extent that people are attacking other members of the polity on the basis of their political views, I think the tendency is more to view that as being a vigorous or sharp political disagreement rather than an actual denigration of the very humanity of the people that you're disagreeing with.
Some of the dialogue does get to the level of calling liberals a scourge of society. How does that comport?
I agree with you that it's possible for political rhetoric to become so extreme as to amount to a sort of hate speech against your political opponents. And I think that we need to try to avoid that to the greatest extent possible and to condemn it when people do engage in that kind of speech. I should add that existing First Amendment jurisprudence treats even racist hate speech as generally being protected by the First Amendment. All the more so, I think, the court would regard the kind of political hate speech that you're talking about as protected.
So there's a wide range of potential consequences. Robert Entman, you pointed out that there are some serious policy implications. One you mentioned was climate change. Another is how Obama approached the war out of his fear of being attacked.
This very much goes along with what Michael was talking about, in that it is rational for Obama to anticipate that if he were to make any move such as, for example, sharply de-escalating the war in Afghanistan, any move that would put him up to the charge of being unpatriotic or soft on defense, that the Republican Party would take that opening and run with it, and it would actually go along with the frame that they've already been pushing about he wasn't really born in the United States and he's a socialist and he's an anti-colonialist and so forth. And I believe that there's substantial evidence, for example, in Bob Woodward's book about Obama's war, that the reason we are still in Afghanistan, the reason we have not curtailed and brought that to a close the way we are doing apparently in Iraq is because of that fear that we're in Afghanistan because of the kinds of incivility that we're talking about right now.
The climate change issue you started to talk about, media have had a profound impact on this. Bob Entman?
In the case of climate change, you have a situation now where all but one of the Republican candidates for the United States Senate in 2010 denied that climate change is a problem, and that one doesn't want to do anything about it. So we're talking about a situation not contemplated by democratic theory, as far as I know, at least in the American context, and that is where one party, for whatever reasons, is unified around something clearly not factual, and clearly there is climate change, and no reputable scientists dispute that to any substantial degree. And if you have that situation, you have a paralyzed policy process, because our particular political process is one that gives minorities, like such as the Republican minority in the Senate, an opportunity to veto pretty much anything that they don't like. And that's what's happened here. So think about this. We really haven't had much in the way of any discussion at all about climate change during the Obama administration. There was a little bit around the Copenhagen conference, but that's it. And this is a huge issue facing the whole world. So now we're talking about our incivility actually affecting not just America, but the globe.
And there was an additional incivility, which was after they hacked into the scientists' email accounts, they really vilified the scientists, which turned a lot of the public against science itself. At least the polls have shown that.
I think that's right, and I think that that can have a chilling effect on how scientists think about reporting their results, which is something that we ought to worry about, I think, as a democratic society. For example, thinking about climate change, another reason that this kind of rhetoric is allowed to exist is because in this particular role, the news media don't tend to act as an appropriate watchdog, which is to say it's kind of an accepted practice in journalism, regardless of whether a story has 1, 2, or 12 sides, to report two sides of a story. And so scientist X says that there's climate change, scientist Y says that there isn't, you decide, and if I report a story that way, then you can't call me biased. If I report almost all scientists who study weather and geography and climate and any variety of those sorts of things conclude that climate change is occurring, that it's accelerated since humans have developed particular technologies, and a couple of folks say that it hasn't occurred, then they open themselves up to charges of being biased, while at the same time would open themselves up to charges of telling the precise truth. But since reporters don't like to adjudicate between competing opinions, it's difficult to disabuse people of beliefs that they have that are false. I think that's all tied up into the style of rhetoric that we've been discussing.
Media have become very bifurcated, where you still have the media that try to do this objective, in quotes, reporting with two sides. But we've also seen this emergence of very one-sided, vilifying kind of media that has added to all of this. Canada and other countries have some restrictions on lying on the air. How is this addressed, and how should it be addressed?
The American Supreme Court has taken a much more absolutist approach to the protection of freedom of speech than many other liberal democratic countries do. And that's true with regard to hate speech, and also true with regard to defamation and, as you said, other forms of lying on the air. And I think that in part it's simply because the First Amendment sounds more absolutist than the corresponding protections for freedom of expression in many other countries. In many other countries, there are explicit constitutional provisions that say that all of the rights that are guaranteed by the Constitution are subject to such limits as are justified in a democratic society. And in general, there's much more of a tendency in these other legal systems to strike a balance between freedom of expression on one hand and other strong public values on the other side.
One of your papers argues that there are other competing rights of citizenship, rights of intellectual freedom, rights of equality, that actually clash with this kind of public discourse. How would you express these nuances?
Particularly in the case of the racist hate speech that we had touched on before, that while I have a right to freedom of speech, that right is grounded in a respect for human dignity and autonomy, and that those same values give rise to other kinds of rights. A right to be free from violence, a right to citizenship and equality and reputation and so forth. In fact, if you go back to the original understanding of the First Amendment, the view was that the right to free speech was an inherent natural right, but it was limited by the rights of other people. I think that the modern Supreme Court has very much lost sight of that view, but that it would very much improve our First Amendment jurisprudence and then maybe in turn improve the quality of our public discourse if we would go back to a view that sees free speech as limited by the rights of other people.
Here's an irony, if I may say, in that the uncivil politics of Supreme Court nominations directly affects the ability of the Supreme Court, or let's say the inclination of the Supreme Court, to take a more nuanced view of the First Amendment. So we used to have a view on the Supreme Court that was a more balanced one between rights of free speech and rights of citizens and so forth. And that view has been pushed aside to a small minority now, and an absolutist version of the First Amendment ensconced, precisely because the Republican Party absolutely refuses to consider liberal justices. So all we've had is very conservative justices nominated by Republican presidents, and very moderate centrist justices nominated by Democratic presidents, because those are the only ones that Republicans would allow to go through. So I think it's really important for listeners to understand that the First Amendment has, the meaning of it has changed in practice over time, and that's very much dependent on the identity of the Supreme Court. And because the parties are so polarized, and in particular the Republican Party is so determined to hold on to power, that it actually affects the way the First Amendment operates in our country at any given time.
Steve Heyman, would you like to add to that?
It has changed. And one very interesting and dramatic change that's taken place over the past 30 or 40 years is that freedom of speech, which used to be primarily viewed as a liberal or a progressive value, has come to be appropriated by the right. So it is now conservatives who tend to be much more absolutist, at least within the Supreme Court, on First Amendment issues than the liberals do. And I think there's a view on the part of the conservative justices that any sort of even reasonable or moderate restrictions on hate speech or on corporate speech is some sort of an effort on the part of the left to suppress conservatives. So that helps to explain why it's the conservatives who have been most absolutist in the protection of hate speech and the conservatives who were responsible for the Citizens United decision.
Michael Wagner, let's bring you back in.
It occurs to me that we see some of these same principles and same, I guess not really principles, tendencies coming into other elements of our politics. And so Bob had made an argument that Republicans nominate extreme Supreme Court justices and Democrats nominate moderate ones. And if we look at the results of the 2010 congressional elections, we find something similar in that there's good evidence that the Republicans who won office for the first time in 2010 are more conservative than the Republicans who were already in office. The Democrats who won office for the first time in 2010 were more conservative than the Democrats who were already in office. And so Democrats who won were ideologically to the right of the Democrats in Congress, just as Republicans who won were ideologically to the right of the Republicans in Congress. And so there seems to be an acceptance amongst candidates for office about who they want to appeal to and how they want to appeal to them. And that, you know, is all wrapped up in the civility of our discourse, how people respond to that kind of rhetoric, how the media report that kind of rhetoric, and how courts allow or don't allow it. And so I think it all telling a similar story, which I think is something for us to really think about.
Where could this go from here into a more civilized discourse? Bob Entman, what are your thoughts? How do we move into more constructive dialogue?
That's an enormously important question. It may sound hard to believe, but it seems to me that we're reaching a point in this country where we need to start thinking of ourselves as having a form of civil conflict. It's not of civil war, but a lot of similarities between now and the pre-Civil War United States of the 1850s are going on. And we do know a lot more, I think, than we did then about how to bring groups that are unalterably opposed together and actually try to gain some common ground on the basis of mutual respect and understanding. So I would propose that we actually have conferences, a series of conferences, where the two sides sit down, and maybe they're not just politicians, but there are other people like professors, for example, in the room, and try to hammer this out in a way that recognizes that this is a little bit verging on going towards just the edge of a situation like Northern Ireland, or we could name many other civil conflicts. So we really need to take it very seriously. I do think that there's a little tendency on the part of Republicans in particular to see this kind of as a game. And at some point, this game becomes pretty dangerous. And that's why I think we ought to name this problem and take it seriously and really try to get both parties to understand that ultimately the stakes are the history, the future of our country and our children. And we really need to step back from where we've been lately.
Steve Heyman.
I would love to see the sort of effort to develop common ground that Bob was just talking about. I may be a little more pessimistic about the ability to do that. My sense is that a lot of the source of the incivility in our current politics comes from the refusal of a certain group of white conservative Americans to accept the very legitimacy of people who aren't like them, racial minorities, Barack Obama being the most prominent example, and that a lot of the incivility in the last years has resulted from just a very powerful backlash against the very idea of having somebody like that in the White House, which goes along with the sort of vilification of liberals that we've been talking about. And Obama has done everything that he can to try to develop that kind of common ground and civil discourse, and it really hasn't succeeded. So I guess my sense is that the first thing that we may have to do is actually to be a little bit more uncivil on the left, in the sense of coming out and very strongly condemning the kind of rejectionist, condemnatory views that we sometimes hear from the right, and that ultimately the best hope for establishing some kind of broader civility is when people who don't fall within the demographic that the Republican Party is appealing to can actually assert enough majority control over the society. The white conservative group recognizes itself as being part of a multicultural and pluralistic and ideologically diverse country, rather than taking the view that their country is being stolen from them and that they essentially do need to start a civil war against their opponent.
I think a couple things are going on here, and I think one is that, as Stephen talked a lot about what elites can do, I think just thinking about the public, one thing that's important to realize is that people are different. Individuals vary, and they do so systematically and in some cases intractably. And so to know that some people, honest to goodness, no matter what you tell them, believe that smaller government is good, and others believe that a more activist government is good. You know, these folks are not likely to change their views on that in a lot of cases. And so it's one way we can promote tolerance is to accept that people do have different views. And one problem with the American people is they drastically overestimate the degree to which people agree with them. And there's actually quite a bit of ideological diversity in the United States. And so I think recognizing that and promoting those differences would go some way toward improving tolerance, which I think could help the problem of uncivility. The second thing is that some recent research from a guy named Brendan Nyhan suggests that a great strategy at the elite level and at the public level to get people to believe things that are true when they don't want to is a strategy of naming and shaming. And so when President Obama said in the recent State of the Union, if you say things that aren't true about this policy, I'm going to call you out, that's the right strategy. He just hasn't done it. So political leaders need, and the news media need to say, you know, this person said something, it was not true. And every time they say it, they need to say it was not true. And so we need more things like PolitiFact, which won a Pulitzer Prize for, you know, kind of rating the truthfulness of what it is our lawmakers say. And, you know, while PolitiFact is an imperfect tool, it's the kind of tool that I think can promote the other kind of incivility that Bob was talking about at the top of our program, that, you know, the right to accept things that are true when they're true and the ability to believe them as fact and to stop rejecting facts for ideological reasons rather than empirically scientific ones.
That's a great place to end. Thank you also very much, Robert Entman, Professor of Media and Public Affairs and International Affairs at George Washington University, author of Projections of Power and Mediated Politics, Stephen Hyman, Professor of Law at Chicago Kent College of Law, author of Free Speech and Human Dignity and Hate Speech in the Constitution, Michael Wagner, Professor of Political Science at University of Nebraska, Lincoln, and co-author of Political Behavior in Midterm Elections and the Consequences of Political Vilification. That is it for today's show. Thank you to all of our guests. An extra special thanks to Ankine Agassian, Melissa Chiprin, who produced this show each week, and to Sud Dongre, our webmaster and web host. Most of all, thank you for listening. And if you missed any part of the show, you can go to scholarcircle.org or armudian.com or kpfk.org. You can also hear us on Stitcher, on iTunes. You can like us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter at armudian. See you next week.